Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today is February 2nd. Today we have Peter Bookvar and Ira Harris. Peter is the Chief Investment Officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory, has a newsletter product named The Book Report, bookreport.com, bookreport.com. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Ira's independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and has stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Richard. Hi, Ira.
Hey, Peter. Richard, this is great. Wow, perfect time to do this too.
Great. That would begin with your macro view on the economy and the financial markets. Peter?
So let's start with the economy because the financial markets are quite different right now. The economy is continuing to weaken in the U.S. U.S. manufacturing sector is in a recession. We saw the ISM report fall below 50 for a third straight month. And you have to go, if you take away the influence of COVID, you have to go back to 2009, the last time we saw manufacturing numbers this low, particularly the new orders component, which fell to 42.5. U.S. housing is basically in a recession. We saw consumer personal consumption in November, December on a real basis fall below zero. And we saw at least the ADP number, we'll see what payrolls look like, a short slowdown in the pace of hiring. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that the economy is in a recession. But, you know, that's not saying much because GDP growth in 2022 on a real basis was only 1%. So going from 1% to something below zero is not necessarily a big stretch. Now, the markets, of course, are a separate story. The markets are partying like it's 2021 again, thinking that the end of Fed Reserve rate hikes and the slowdown in inflation is enough to regenerate markets. It's not going to regenerate the economy because rates are going to stay high for a while, but markets don't necessarily care about the economy. They're really only focused on when the Fed is done raising interest rates. But somehow I've ignored quantitative tightening, which is occurring at a pretty rapid pace every month. So we're definitely in a mini euphoric phase in the markets, but a more challenged state with the economy.
Yeah, exactly. Great points. And your thoughts, Ira?
I have really nothing. I think Peter covers it. And anybody who's listening to this, when Peter talks about housing, you better pay attention because Peter was 18 months early than the Fed when they were talking about transitory inflation. And Peter, along with Jimmy Bianco, were probably the two most out there talking about pay attention to this owner's equivalent rent. Yeah. And with what's going on in housing, it's not picking it up. And he's talking about this now, pay attention. And we heard from Powell, and we're going to get into it. We heard from Lagarde today. The Bank of England is a sideshow, except that they actually had a 7-2 vote. Again, two people again wanted to no changes. And I admire at least people who are willing to vote in dissent, because it is one of the issues with the Fed. There's no dissenters. How can there be no dissenters? But we'll get into deeper with that. But I have really nothing. Peter was really said it all very, very well.
Okay. And Peter, what are your thoughts from yesterday's Federal Reserve policy statements? And also, there was a comment after by the Bank of Japan that you were mentioning before the podcast, if you can relate that as well.
So the Fed statement, and this has been the case for many, many statements, ends up being really just a slight tweak on the prior statement, which makes that the press conference the real market moving event. And you know, Powell, you know, on one hand is in a difficult position in the sense of markets just so want to find dovishness in him to celebrate that if he sort of gives them that bone, the markets are going to run with it. Even if he tries to offset that with hawkish commentary. And he started the press conference trying to be hawkish because he quickly said, yeah, we hiked and we're probably going to hike again. And that inflation is slowing, but it still is very high. Like he, it seemed like that was his intent. And then as the press conference went on, he just totally dropped the ball. He started talking about disinflation. I think he made a comment about keeping rates higher for longer, but we'll see, like qualifying it. And then his real screw up was when he talked about financial conditions. Now, financial conditions, as we know, has become an important component of monetary policy. And this goes back to Alan Greenspan and the creation of the Fed put, where asset prices go, in Greenspan's eyes, would create a wealth effect and dictate economic activity. And that has henceforth been carried forward by multiple central banks. And in the December press conference, Powell specifically said, again, our policy works through financial conditions. So it was towards the end of the press conference when Powell was asked about financial conditions again. And he said, well, they're really no different today than they were when we last met in mid-December. Meanwhile, if you look at the Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index, it's the easiest it's been since February 2022, before they started raising interest rates. And the Goldman Sachs version, and they have their own components and they're weighted differently. That's why there's a difference. The Goldman Sachs one is the easiest since last August. So either he's not paying attention to markets, or he's purposely just doesn't want to push back on markets. But now he's creating a problem for himself because, and we're seeing that with the ECB, because yields are collapsing in Europe today with the 50 basis point rate increase and Lagarde saying they're going to raise another 50 and begin QT. So the markets are now easing while central banks are tightening. And that is now becoming a potential problem because if that continues, and that helps to regenerate the housing market and other parts of the economy, well, then they're just going to go back to repeating the 1970s again of seeing a rise in inflation, having it fall, getting complacent, backing off, having it then reaccelerate to a level above the prior peak. Then it falls off, they get complacent, they back off, and then it accelerates into the double digits into the late 70s, into 1980, 81. So you wonder now, like I actually thought like Powell, you know, has talked about the lessons of the 70s. I thought he would stick to a tough stance and yes, acknowledge inflation slowing down, acknowledge, yes, the Fed is almost done raising interest rates, but then say, but we are going to be tight because we don't want to repeat the 1970s and the financial conditions easing and the markets ripping is making our job even tougher. I thought that's the stance he would take, and unfortunately, he did not. Now, he speaks next week, and we'll see whether he walks that back at all, but it was not an impressive performance if you wanted to sort of portray some toughness on inflation. In fact, he was sort of all over the place, but again, like I said earlier, the markets only focus on where is he dovish, so for any of other hawkishness, that was canceled out by that dovishness.
And also there was a follow-on comment by the Bank of Japan you mentioned.
So the Bank of Japan, of course, is debating on, or I should say the government is debating on who should replace Kuroda. We know that that is the possibility of being an internal hire or an external hire. It can be the deputy governor is on the list, which may end up being the case if they want the easy way out, or they may go outside. Now, the outside potential candidates seemed to be a bit more hawkish than those inside. And there was a story on Bloomberg about a Columbia professor who is close with Kuroda, that is a candidate for it, who talked about the possibility that 2023, the Bank of Japan can declare that their inflation goals have been met, and therefore it's time to start walking back their extraordinary easing. And what the Bank of Japan does this year, I think, is going to be a huge factor in where global bonds go, where global interest rates go, and what that means also for other asset prices, because they're sort of the last central bank to give it up. And because they've been so extreme on one side, you know, you could see a rapid dislocation on the other side, depending on how they plan this out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting comments and great observations. Your thoughts, Ira, on all of the...
Yeah, there's so much here, which is, I guess, why we're sitting here doing this. So let's go to the financial conditions. And as we were talking about before we started taping, if you go back to the December meeting, the December press conference, the first question was asked by Steve Leisman about financial conditions, in which he noted how Wall Street back in December was seeing that financial conditions were easing and were pushing back against what the Fed's outlook was. Well, and Powell's response was, well, over the last year. So rather than going for the last 3 months and looking to see, or November, December, and seeing what was taking place in the financial markets, and I would actually date that, by the way, to November 2nd, which was the previous press conference, you had seen the dollar come off quite a bit. And I think a lot of the easing of financial conditions is due to the selling off of the dollar, because Peter and I have discussed it over many months before that, as the dollar was rising in value, it was a huge albatross upon the neck of the global financial system because of the huge amount of borrowing in dollars. And while the Fed was being the most aggressive, of course, it was taking the dollar with it. And we got all the way up to 114. And I hate using this metric, but it's what I'm left with, of the dollar index. And the dollar index has gone from one, if you go the week of November 2nd, you go from 113, and we're all the way down to 101, maybe even below it. Let's see, I don't have to guess at this. I have all that data right in front of me. Right now we're at 101.54. So you've seen a substantial easing, and you'll be amazed at how closely it correlates with the rise in the S&P, for lack of a, so you're seeing that, and with the bonds. So everything is kind of going together. The bonds are, to me, a different story, and I'm sure we'll get into that. And yesterday, as Peter noted, when he did talk about financial conditions and he got a few questions from it, he went back to that year period. It was the same language he used in answering Steve Leisman's question back in December, and the market senses that. And as Peter talked about, with Powell's a lawyer by trade, who happens to run the central bank, but he's a lawyer and he understands words and the importance of words. And in yesterday's press conference, we must have heard the word disinflation, I'm going to say 8 times, maybe it was 12 times, but it was more than a one-off. It wasn't a mistake, because he kept coming back to it, that we were starting to enter a disinflation. And even some of the media picked up about it in the write-ups of the press conference overword. So that's what really ignited this market. And I agreed with Peter. I go, well, yeah, the statement itself was no big deal, but he's certainly going to get more hawkish from everything that we've heard. You know, yes, Waller had already indicated, I'm not giving Nick Timiraos that type of, but Waller had told us 10 days ago it was going to be 25 basis points. And I think he's probably Powell's confident. They seem to confident more than anybody else. They seem to say things the same. So when it wasn't, and you know, in Yiddish, there's a saying, you know, don't piss on my head and try to convince me it's raining. Well, that's what happened. The market pissed on Powell's head yesterday, and he was trying to convince him. He believed it was raining. No, they were pissing on you and you kept going this way in the market, and we're still going that way. I mean, we're making highs. So the market has totally told them, we have no faith in you. So, you know, and coming back to Peter's point, it makes me wonder, even though the vote's unanimous, it has to be that there's far more dissension in the Fed, and he gives into it by being somewhat dovish. Otherwise, it makes no sense. Because he is a lawyer and words are important to lawyers. Why did he do this? And interestingly, one of the things that really took off was the gold. The gold, you know, as the dollar started coming off and the bonds started to rally, gold, now gold has retraced all that. I think that's more due to the ECB raising 50 basis points and basically to use Madame Lagarde's words, the intention, and intention is a strong word, as she noted, to raise another 50 basis points in March. So, and yet the currency, gold broke and the euro broke, but it's coming back a little bit. But all these things, this is where we exist. So.
And very interesting. How do you see it playing out, Peter, in terms of the yield, U.S. yield curves, U.S. dollar, inflation numbers going in through this year?
Well, I'm sorry, Ira, was that for
you? No, that's for you, Peter. I'll pick up on
it. So the curve is still obviously deeply inverted because while the Fed is no longer going to be raising rates that much more, you know, obviously the markets are understanding that that's going to slow things down. But, you know, I think the giddiness in the markets is not understanding that, and we'll only have to see whether he follows through. Just by keeping rates at current levels for a longer period of time, that in itself is a form of monetary tightening. Because we went through this extraordinary 15 years when rates were essentially zero, mm-hmm. and parts of the world obviously negative.
Yeah.
And then you have this vertical move higher within a year. So by keeping rates elevated, every day, every week, every month that goes on from here, somebody's debt is coming due. And if they can either pay it off or it's going to have to be refinanced at a much higher interest rate than the loan that's coming due.
Mm-hmm.
And if I took out a 10-year ARM 10 years ago, well, my ARM is going to be readjusting at a much higher interest rate. Now, maybe after 10 years, I have a lot more equity in it. I paid down principal. It may not affect me much, but there's going to be others that are going to get affected. It's going to be businesses that have had sort of a rate shock with that have had floating rate debt where they've seen an immediate rise in interest rates, and others that just any debt coming due this year. If you're in commercial real estate, chances are that loan you took out to develop a property or to buy an existing one, you probably paid 2.75%, 3% interest rate. Well, if you need to refinance that this year, you're probably paying 7-8%, and that's a big deal. And at the same time, the economy is slowing, earnings are rolling over. We're going to see a decline in earnings this year over year. We're already seeing a pretty crappy fourth quarter earnings season where typically 75% of companies beat, and it's not even 70%. So I think the fundamental backdrop, which is deteriorating, which is another way of saying that we're now dealing with the economic consequences of higher interest rates, is being swept under the rug because the market thinks, well, tightening is over just because the Fed's no longer raising rates. Tightening is continuing on at current levels of interest rates. And, you know, the markets love QE, but don't seem to be perturbed by QT. But QT will continue on and is just beginning in Europe and is going to continue on in the UK and Canada and other places. So now the Fed's balance sheet's still, after declining $500 billion, is still double where it was pre-COVID. So there's a lot of QT potentially ahead of us.
And what about the U.S. dollar, short-term, medium-term, how all of this plays out on the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think last year was instructive in trying to figure out in this environment what moves the dollar. And the dollar index, and I agree with Ira, it's, you know, we have to take with a grain of salt because about two-thirds of it is yen and euro. It's not balancing for trade. It was up about 17% January through October. But once the market started to get comfortable that inflation was slowing and that the Fed was slowing the pace of its interest rate increases, poof, there went the dollar rally. Now, this is in the face of all the challenges in Europe, zero rates in with Japan. You know, it told you that maybe the dollar rally was just nothing more than an interest rate differential thing. And that once that gap started to close with other central banks, then that was the end of the dollar rally. I mean, all the Bank of Japan had to do was tweak their yield curve control from 25 to 50. So we're talking 25 basis points. And that was enough to spark a huge rally in the yen, just a 25 basis point tweak. So that tells me that the dollar rally is essentially over, if that was the main catalyst. And in terms of driving further weakness from here, we have to wonder if maybe some of the other flaws of the dollar start to get exposed. And I say flaws, and I'm talking about our deficits, our trade deficit, our current account deficit, our budget deficit. I mean, we're going into this recession with the US budget deficit at 5.5% of GDP. That is usually where it bottoms at the end of a recession, not on the cusp of one. So maybe, and the debt ceiling could sort of expose the challenges that we have, that US debts and deficits maybe start dominating the conversation. Now that is sort of something that happens over time. I don't know that's necessarily an event, but if, like I said, we're past the bull fundamental foundation for the dollar rally, then we could start to see some of the sort of the challenges that the dollar and the flaws that the dollar has, and this debt situation this year and budget deficit could expose that, therefore leading to further dollar weakness.
Yeah, that's great perspective. Your thoughts, Ira?
I 100% agree. But the only outlier that I have with it is, and it's an outlier to the way I'm seeing the board, is the fact that today the 10-year yield is 3.37 on the 10-year U.S. Treasury, and that's without the type of foreign buying of bonds that we've seen. There's just not that flow. We know that the Chinese have stemmed the. Certainly the Russians are not buying. The Japanese have certainly stepped back as rates are starting to rise in Japan. And that's been one of the biggest reasons that the yen is reversed. And everybody, there are an awful lot of people who got that wrong, but I'll tell you, two people who didn't are on this podcast right now because we're looking positively towards Japan even before that. I mean, we were talking about Japanese banks, the Nikkei, you know, that things were priced, they were too complacently priced low in opposite to the complacency that took place in the US and in other Western or developed markets with low interest, with uber low interest rates. So we are seeing these things, and that 10 year, that's why I'm looking for the curve to steepen. I don't know when. As being at 70 basis points inverted right now in this environment, I find interesting. But I view it as an opportunity. When? I don't know when. I'll be patient because I'm a risk manager first and foremost. I always have ideas percolating in my head. But, and it's not just my return of capital. It's the way I manage my capital, which is most important. And that's what I strive to do. So it'll come. It'll come. I'm not the only one out there seeing it. Because I'm not in, you know, Powell used that word disinflation. There are others who think we're going to go into a deflation issue because of the money supply issue and quantitative tightening coming on fast with the famous Druckenberg Druckenmiller comments about the double shotgun that we're raising rates. We shall see with that. But I am in the camp, and I was just talking with Chris Whalen. We were talking about it. The Fed and the other central banks will not allow deflation. You know, it's my position why I like gold, because there's a whole lot of issues at hand, and there are a whole lot of financial fragilities. Now, I'm not talking about financial conditions. I'm talking about what we know as fragilities out there with the massive over-leverage that still exists due to 12, 13 years of central bank policies. And then, you know, don't forget it, 18 months ago, we were still talking about how much debt was negative yielding in nominal terms, not real terms, but nominal terms. You know, the bunds were negative. Most of Europe was negative. The Japanese were, well, their long end wasn't, but the Japanese JGBs were yielding 10 basis points. The US treasuries were 130, 140. It's not that long ago. And with that, as Peter pointed out, you have massive amounts of leverage debt and leverage debt that has been taken on that has to be refinanced now. Now, it's interesting that the NASDAQ is leading the rally for the last day and a half as the market gets that sense that maybe the Fed is softer than they previously thought. And because so much of that is dependent upon the easiness of money to be attracted to it, we're seeing that. So the market is definitely taking that unto itself. And Peter makes that, it's a beautiful point, because we have to deal with it. And institutionally, I read that article from Bloomberg over the weekend about corporate pension funds being flush with about $1 trillion in cash. Why? Because of the huge interest that they've earned all of a sudden that they weren't earning before. Now they have to place it. And so where are they placing it? They're buying the longer end of the curve, because they're meeting their liabilities with almost perfect duration, which they couldn't do before. So we are getting that end, and that answers one of the questions that I've been wondering, who's buying this? Why would you buy a 10-year today at 3.4 today? In inflation, by the Fed's measures, will be conservative, is let's say 4.8, and I'm really being conservative. Yeah. You're still at a negative yield, unless you think that this country is going into a deflationary spiral and that layoffs are going to come. And I don't get it. So, you know, that's just my sense. I'd rather buy a 1-year treasury bill, which probably today, I don't know, Peter, what is it, 4.7 today?
1 year, yeah, about 4.60.
Yeah, so I mean, there's all kinds of ways. And yet, that type of overnight and short-term rates are not attracting investors back to the dollar. So we're still sensing that. And more importantly, since that November 2nd meeting, which I call the setup meeting, remember Kashkari came out afterwards and was praising Powell because the FOMC statement on November 2nd was fairly dovish. So the first response was that the markets rallied. The dollar sold off, the equities rallied, the bonds rallied, the metals rallied. And then Powell began his press conference and was very hawkish in the press conference, and everything reversed. But by the end of the week, the stock market was only down a little bit. Gold had actually rallied higher on the week. The currencies had actually closed basically unchanged on the week with all that hawkish talk. So everything has changed then. And since then, rates have gone up, but gold is $200 higher, and Peter has been adamant about staying the course on the bullish metals, and rightfully so, because he sees the central banks, I believe, as I see them, that they're fighting for their credibility. And right now, the equities tell me that their credibility is somewhat still questioned, and the gold goes right with it. So that's where we exist, and that's where we sit.
Yeah, and just to take a few other steps with the rise in interest rates and its impact, the ECB this week came out with their lending data, and bank lending standards are the tightest since 2011 for corporate lending. The demand for mortgages is down like 75%, which obviously makes sense because rates are higher. But you've had sort of a rate shock you're going to have it continue in Canada, in New Zealand, in Australia, in the UK, where there's a lot of adjustable rate mortgages out there. So that's why this rise in rates is not just because it hasn't hurt so much yet. It's something that plays out as time progresses in the years to come. Again, because it's such a shock in level compared to where it was.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you bring up Canada because, and Richard's sitting in Canada, but yeah. the Canadian 10-year, which not long ago was yielding 50 or 30, 40 basis points more than the US, is now yielding 50 basis points less. So, which is really interesting. And they still have the most inverted curve. They're at negative 83. And that's with, well, of course, the fall in the 10-year yields. I mean, they've gone from 4% not long ago down to 283 today. So it's really interesting. And that's, as Peter points out, and Richard, you know far better than we do about the mortgage situation in Canada and the lending requirements. So
Yeah, it's crazy. It's gone really tight. More down payment is required. And there's all kinds of new rules, regulations on the foreign buying as well, some taxes. If the property is empty, they just started that yesterday. But just further to Ira's comments on nominal terms versus real terms, Peter, what are your thoughts on equities? Do you see the potential for like a 1968 to 1982 sort of sideways on equities, but in real terms going lower? Or do you think nominally will also go lower for US equity?
I still think we're in a bear market. I'm gonna talk in nominal terms. The S&P 500 in 10 years can be 4,000 or 4,800, same level or range that it was this year outside of the, or I should say going back the last couple of years outside of the declines below 4,000, just because of the dominance of these mega cap tech stocks that, it's just hard to continue that pace of growth. And it's just the law of large numbers and so on. That's not to say that there can be plenty of other opportunities where US stocks can do okay, particularly value stocks. I think that this is just a bear market rally, and I understand it. You know, when you think about 2022, you know, the two things that hit everyone on the head was 40-year highs in inflation and the most aggressive monetary tightening in 40 years. And then by the end of the year, people say, okay, well, inflation's rolling over, the Fed's almost done. You know, you can stop hitting me in the head. And I understand this rally. I get it, makes perfect sense. I just don't think that, I think that battle has been won with inflation and rate hikes. I just don't think the bear market war has been won, you know, if history is any guide. Mm-hmm. Because there's economic impact that we talked about that a higher rate environment has on the economy and earnings. And if there's any existence left of a relationship between stock prices and corporate fundamentals, then this still has a ways to play out because the earnings story is getting worse. And you look at fourth quarter numbers so far, and we still have more to go. You know, the historical beat rate is 75% of companies. It's last time I saw it was 69%. And that may not sound like much of a difference, but it was almost a guarantee that, you know, 75%+ companies were going to beat. And the rate of beat is shrinking and earnings will be down this year. And again, if there's any relationship between corporate fundamentals and the value of their stock, then I think that, that should be noted. And we're not going to continue to be off to the races just because the Fed has done raising interest rates, which was, again, the most aggressive rate hiking cycle in 40 years, while they're still doing QT at $95 billion a month. And one thing, and I wanted to actually hear Ira's opinion on this, because just to throw back a question is like, you know, I get people throw me the charts of, yeah, the Fed's doing QT, but the Treasury general account is going down and it's offsetting it. Or the reverse repo facility is falling, therefore it's offsetting it. And in terms of its impact on the stock market, I'm thinking to myself, I don't recall Treasury general account money coming in and out of the stock market. It's just the Treasury paying bills, right? Or it goes up and they're selling Treasuries, so money's coming in. And when money's going out, it's paying for Medicare and Social Security and other things. And with respect to the reverse repo facility, well, when QE went up, the RRP went up, and QT takes place and RRP goes down. And I get, you know, a money market fund, if they're parking less at the RRP, and that means maybe they're buying more T-bills. Well, they're buying T-bills. They're not buying the S&P 500. So I don't get this people rationalizing QT with these other sort of liquidity flows. I get it on paper, but I just don't get it in reality.
Ira, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that there, it's a great...
You know what I'm talking about, Ira, right?
Yes, this is a great discussion. I know somebody who writes about this all the time, who I have great respect for. And she has touched on this more, as has Joseph Wang. You know, everybody's been visiting this because it's an important question. But I think from the market standpoint, they go, well, it's just... It's not, they're trying to convince themselves that there's not a de minimis action towards liquidity, even though the quantitative tightening is changing hands. And the rates are, and the Fed has a problem here because, well, they're watching it. And Lori Logan actually did a good job of speaking to it, because you can't just talk about the RRP. You have to discuss, to me, the standing repo facility, which they were, I didn't like the way they put it into action, but they put it into action. It's been over, I think, 2 years already, July of 21, I believe, is when the Financial Times ran that article on the day of an FOMC meeting announcing that it was going to take place, which I found kind of preposterous. But so all of these venues that the Fed is trying to do to try to show that they have control over the liquidity and reserves that are sloshing around in the system. And when the bank, and I think, Peter, when the markets look at that and go, well, there's still a lot of liquidity at the end of the day, why am I buying the equity market? Because I still see all this liquidity. And even if when the liquidity diminishes from the extremely elevated levels, nominal interest rates, real interest rates, as we know, are still negative. Even using the most conservative, and I know then everybody will flash their 10-year charts, right? And if you look out 10-year with expectations, real interest rates are actually, what, 1.6 positive? I don't get that. That means nothing to me, those 10-year rate expectations. Hell, you can't even tell me what's going to be in 10 days. And the volatility in the marketplace certainly reflects that. So you're going to... I'm not comfortable predicting 10 months, let alone 10 years. Okay, you want to use the 5-year overnight, the 5-year swap? Great. That's not how I, you know, yes, there are certain people who have to make decisions based on that, but that's not my metric. I have far more than, and I'm still looking at the overnight and the overnight to 3 months. And yeah, look at 3 month T-bills, 6 month T-bills are what we just talked about, 4.6, 4.7.
Yeah.
Right? I'm very happy parking my ass there, to tell you, as you rightly point out, they're buying T-bills. And then we want to applaud that the pension funds, corporate pension funds, government pension funds are a whole different story, but corporate pension funds are awash in cash because they're getting these interest rate payments finally. You know, as I laughed about last year, if you had $1 million T-bill in let's go back to August, September of 2021, and you bought that, you would maybe make, I want to be exact here, probably about $1,800 for the year, $2,000 for the year. It's so minimis, it's a joke. But that same T-bill today is being paid $47,000, And that's when you look at those metrics and you go, well, this is where the money's coming from, but it's coming from somewhere. And it's coming from, now we're talking, you know, you want to talk the budget process. I think it was November's interest rate expense on the debt was $54 billion. And as you point out, Peter, it's going to grow because these rates, all these things that are coming due are going to be refinanced at a higher rate. So that number is going to grow. And then we get into the very difficult situations. They better find some way to resolve this debt. And again, there's no partisanship in me in this discussion whatsoever, because you're going to have this issue of this growing interest cost on the debt.
Peter, on the S&P 500 index, do you see that going lower than the lows back in October, like 3,500, like maybe down to 3,350 or 3,000?
Yeah, I think that's the most likely outcome when all said and done. You know, that's not to say that some stocks probably have maybe seen their bear market lows. I said this before, like I characterize a bear market in three stages. And the first one is you take a lot of the froth out of the bull market. And I think we're well, you know, we've completed that. To me, the second phase is, you know, the earnings and economic degradation from, you know, the rate hikes and the higher rate environment. And I think that, and I think we're just really beginning that phase. And then the third phase usually comes rather quickly because it's just everyone throws in the towel and no one wants to buy a stock again. You know, there's that level of disgust that typifies the bottom in bear markets. And I mean, you just look at how January is, we're not even close to that. And we certainly didn't get there last year. Last year was more of a slow bleed. Certainly not a throw in the towel. You still have all these believers that, you know, we're just going to somehow magically go back to 2021. I gave an analogy this week of, from the movie Dazed and Confused, the Matthew McConaughey character, who was in his 20s, who just couldn't let go of high school and wanted to go back and hung out with high school kids. And basically, I was saying that the market just wants to go back to high school, but we're not going back to 2020, 2021. We're not going back to zero rates. We're not going back to QE. We're not going back to that magical 1-2% inflation rate. You know, those days are over, but the market wants to believe that we somehow will. And I understand, again, I understand why we're rallying here and we can continue, but I just think that there are more reality checks that are needed, and investors still need to be somewhat sober through this period, because it's not just going to be, you know, an easy fix. And the Fed stopping their rate hikes is not the end of its impact for reasons that, you know, stated.
And what about thoughts on emerging market equities, Chinese equities, Southeast Asia, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia?
So that's where I've been pretty bullish. I've been very bullish on this China reopening. And, you know, it's interesting, like it didn't come out of the blue, China reopening. We didn't wake up one day and China said, you know what, we're getting rid of all the rules. There was a progression of events. You started to see it in Hong Kong. Like to me, Hong Kong was sort of like a petri dish for how Beijing was going to unveil this eventual end to COVID. And then China released like these 20 rules. And then there was, so it was like this progression of events that led up to those protests. And people said, you know, enough is enough. And then boom, just like that, the Chinese government rolled over and said, okay, instead of waiting until March or April to get through flu season, let's just rip the Band-Aid off right now. And I think that we have to understand that we're talking about a $17 trillion economy. You're talking about 17, 18% of the global population that has been essentially chained up for 3 years, that is now unleashed. Now, the manufacturing side China did a good job, I believe, through COVID in keeping things going. And whether it was closed loop or whatever, like Apple didn't really have an issue getting phones out of their suppliers in China. So I don't necessarily think we're going to see some relief on the supply side on the China reopening, because it never really was that crimped. You know, supply chain challenges were a lot about transportation and shipping and semiconductors. The consumer in China, that's where you're going to see the most pronounced impact. And it's not just for China, it's for the entire Asian region. It's for Europe, that does a lot of business with China. Now, overall, China's Europe's third largest trading partner outside of the US and the UK. But for Germany, China's their second, is their first largest, is their biggest trading partner. Japan, Indonesia, all these countries are going to benefit tremendously from this China reopening. Commodity prices getting to, you know, South America and Argentina and Brazil and so on. I think as we sort of get into Q2, Q3 this year, when China fully reopens and that COVID is not causing an issue, because right now there is an issue with this reopening, just as we saw here, just as we saw in Europe, and it's the labor component.
Yeah.
So Las Vegas Sands, which we happen to own, they own half Macau. Well, they couldn't open one of their hotels because they couldn't find enough people. They couldn't find enough workers. So there's going to be an issue reopening China from a labor standpoint. So there's going to be growing pains here on the reopening. But once it reaches, again, with Q2, Q3, a level of normality, relatively speaking, you know, I don't see how oil is not north of $125, and other commodities are much higher, and that this whole slide down in inflation, you know, has the potential of picking back up again, you know, creating further challenges for any central bank that gets complacent.
Great points, perspective. Your thoughts, Ira, on the...
It's just a great perspective. And you know what? And again, last time Peter and I did a podcast, we talked about Japanese banks and the way to play the peripheries and margins around the opening of China. And that was... And really, Louis Gavet has been really good with this, because we get so excited. Believe me, I can bash China as much as everybody else, as well as I respect the massive change that has taken place there, especially since 1979, 1978 with Deng Xiaoping. I have great respect for it, but I don't have to respect the way that they silence criticism at some time. As I've maintained this, once they wouldn't let Google operate freely, I became very suspect. And so we're going back over 20 years, but that doesn't mean I don't find things from an investment point, and especially around the margins. And Peter's margins have now expanded, especially to Latin America, and who are going to get advantage here. Look at Brazil with the coming record crop in soybeans, right? This is going to feed them, and no pun intended, enormously. And you got Lula, and Lula understands the global financial situation far better than his previous, and he did a really good job of putting a lot of the right people in place. I know there are some people, and when we were out with Caroline Miller, she was not nearly as positive about Brazil as I would be with Lula. I think Lula has a great, much greater sense of what's going on. So there's plenty of opportunities down there. You got Chile, you've got Canada. As I had a discussion yesterday with these two guys, and one came out of Phillips 66, he was great. I'm not going to use his name because I don't have permission, but he was not. And the pipeline that is now going to go to Vancouver, right, to export oil to Asia. It's only meant for Asia. That's where the oil is going. So we're seeing plenty of that. And I think Peter and I talked, I really believe, because we were talking about Tokyo Mitsubishi, which is up 40%. It's down today and it's been struggling here a little bit. But you look at, they're going to get a huge advantage with what's going on if China is truly opening to the degree. And Lewis was 100% right that the Chinese don't suppress. This is not 1989 with Tiananmen, that he made the point. They listen more than you think. And when they opened up like that, you know, I almost sat back. I said, oh, this is kind of shocking. As Peter said, rip the Band-Aid off. And I said, what is he doing? Is the Chinese Communist Party saying to the Chinese people, okay, you think you're right? Okay, we're going to show you what's going to happen because you're not listening to the party. So go ahead, we're going to open up everything. And if people die, this is what you want, this is what you're going to get. And I had to think about that for a while. But I think they looked at it and said, enough was enough. And as Peter's point, you know, people have been sitting, you know, these are like coming off a submarine, you know, a bunch of sailors who come into Bangkok, you know, after being locked up for 3 years, and they have their paychecks waiting for them. And China is really interesting. I had a discussion with a group of people the other day, and when they were talking about, they were guessing at the debt to GDP level in China, and, you know, of course, they were making it larger than the U.S., but the debt to the GDP level in China, the government debt, is 50%. But the big difference is their savings rate is 40%. So right. They're sitting on oodles and oodles of cash, right, waiting, you know, and you're starting to see it now. Everybody's looking for a thrust up in the commodity markets. I don't know. I'm going to watch the yuan. And I go back to, you know, we've discussed this trade for 2.5 years. On financial repression authority. So that yen yuan is really interesting. And now so the yen yuan, when it goes higher, when it's more yen to a yuan, of course, yen is weakening. Well, now we've dropped below the 200-day moving average, which came in, I believe, at around 19 and a half yen to a yuan. We're down to 19.1 today, but it's worth watching because we went and made highs at the same highs we made in 1998, or, you know, I'm not going to go back to the charts, but in those periods, and those were the highs at 20 and a half, 21 yen to the yuan, which were really weak. But now we're coming back the other way. So I'm really paying attention because I think the Korean won, everybody's starting to get a little bulled up around the margins, as Peter points out, in Asia. It's, you know, it's Lewis sees it the same way. Mark Faber sees it the same way. So, you know, and I'm more comfortable playing in the Japanese banks, even though they've been miserable for three decades. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering when really sizable U.S. investors, and I go back to think about when COVID, at the beginning of COVID, and Buffett and Munger had talked about an investment that they made, a sizable investment into the Japanese trading companies. And, you know, you're looking, you thought about it, but it's only because he was able to buy it cheap with a great return.
Also a genius because he was also borrowing money in yen.
Right. Yeah. For nothing. Yeah. Listen, I can have my problems with Buffett when he speaks about certain things, especially when he goes after the CME, which I think he's duplicitous about, by the way, but that's my own bias. But there is no better person, as you point out. He's the greatest insurance company operator in the world, probably that there's ever been. And that's what he knows how to do. He knows how to use cheap money to acquire real assets. And you better scour the world and go, where are the real assets? Where can I buy cheap assets? You know, it's like we laugh. You know, I was talking with Bruce Whalen before and we were laughing. I said, you know, I'm buying European financials. I haven't touched one in 15 years since I would buy Deutsche Bank and look at Deutsche. I haven't touched one, but again, I like Commerce is getting hit hard today, but it's been a nice steady move. It pays no dividend. I'm waiting for them to finally announce a dividend, but it's probably trading for 20% a book. So those are the things I'm looking for if I'm buying anything. And that's to say, Tokyo Mitsubishi is a joke. They make nothing but money hand over fist. They've paid a nice dividend. It's time for them to start increasing. But I'm waiting to see whether there are a lot of powerful U.S. financials who start to move into Japanese looking for things.
Just a final question. Peter, your thoughts on industrial metals and precious metals?
So the industrial metal side is obviously two things from here. One, China, obviously, on the reopening, but with the drag of the distress in residential real estate there. But of course, the secular growth driver of needing copper and cobalt and nickel and lithium and so on to power the, you know, the renewable dreams that the world has, whether that's from the electricity standpoint or transportation. And we certainly need a lot of it if some of the big picture goals that have been thrown out have any chance of getting realized. I think helping reach those goals is uranium and nuclear, but that's another thing that we actually are bullish on. So while the demand side is going to be in question this year because of the slowdown in the U.S. economy, offset by the reopening of the Chinese economy, I think this year is more difficult to call some of the industrial metals, but obviously looking at over 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the demand is going to well overwhelm the supply side. Mm-hmm. On precious metals, you know, if I'm right, if Ira and I are right on the weaker dollar, then I think there's a lot of potential upside in gold and silver.
Mm-hmm. Great. And your final thoughts, Ira, on these industrial metals, precious metals?
Yeah, you know, I'm totally in the same camp. I trade a lot of metals. Copper has been on a pretty dynamic move here. You know, some of it is based on the reopening of China, and of course, the others are with the Inflation Reduction Act, with all the green initiatives built in there. Now you have Europe firing back as to how to respond to the protective measures that they deem the U.S. government has put in place in order to generate the type of activity in alternative energy. So that has taken copper up. So that, of course, remains bullish. But I advise people, when you listen to us talk about this, don't just dump in and do this. Go do your damn work, or send your money to Peter and let Blakely manage it for you, because that's just not, you know, everybody gets all, you know, this is not Reddit. This is, you know, some really significant thought processes that go in there. And, you know, we monitor. Yesterday was a classic example. I put a spread. Now I'm already out of it. But during all that pandemonium, when gold rallied $25, the platinum didn't go anywhere. So I look for opportunities within that. I like platinum. I think platinum has a really good story going forward, especially because Russia mines 30 to 35% of the platinum, and how much is coming out, we don't know anything. And the United States has gotten a huge benefit here, especially the administration, because natural gas prices have dropped so dramatically, even as we've shipped that much more to Europe, because Germany did an amazing thing building 3 offshore LNG platforms in order to receive all that natural gas. So those were supposed to take 3 years. They did it in 8 months. So it'll tell you when you really get your mind to something. But the precious metals and the, I'm still bullish on them for so many ways, until the central banks, until real yields truly go positive on the short end, then I'll change my direction. But you see what's going on, and the market does it, just tells you. And the gold has performed very well against a myriad of currencies, and that's how we look at them. Again, so you don't just run and jump. So that's my point. And even on the stocks that I mentioned, don't just run and buy them. Go do your work and find your points. I can't tell you what your risk tolerance is. You have to figure out your own risk tolerance.
Great. And just coming to an end here, how can our listeners, viewers, learn more about your work, Peter?
Well, they can read my daily missives at bookreport.com, bookreport.com. They can file it for free or subscribe if they like it. And if they're interested in any wealth management services, they can check out our website at bleakley.com.
Great. And Ira?
Just me and you, Richard, and whoever else we can sit down and have a conversation. I think these are really good, and there's a lot to learn. So,
great. Thank you so much, Peter and Ira. Thank you.
All right, Peter, I'll talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Sure.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.